Hey everyone, it's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community and we cannot do this without you.
Like, this is us, like, learning in public and, like, trying to...
Literally learning in public.
Yeah.
We're at Vancouver Public Library.
Yes.
There are glass doors.
Yes.
We're literally learning in public.
Pulling back the curtain of silence.
And learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala.
This is Scene.
Brown-eyed activism.
Healing at the intersections.
So for our last episode, you had given me a list of questions beforehand, and at the top of the list was, where in your life have you experienced underprotection from men? So a lot came up for me. I felt like the easier question to answer would be, where in my life have I experienced protection from men? Which is... you know, wouldn't have much to say, but it would be a much shorter story. And then I started just thinking about so many of my experiences with men that I had in especially my late teens and my 20s. And all of these feelings that came up, just these experiences of fear of men and disappointment in men and frustration with men and a lack of understanding of men and giving up on men and all of these things. And I wanted to talk about why, because, okay, spoiler alert, our BIPOC of the week this week is bell hooks.
I was gonna say, like, who are we doing for BIPOC of the week? But that's good, that's good. I like it.
Yeah, it's not a man. Sorry. Okay. It's bell hooks, and I'm going to be quoting from her throughout the episode because she wrote a book called The Will to Change, Men, Masculinity, and Love. Mm. And she said in the beginning, we have been so well socialized in patriarchal culture to be silent on the subject of men. But more than silenced, we've been socialized to be the keepers of grave and serious secrets, especially those that could reveal the everyday strategies of male domination, how male power is enacted and maintained in our private lives.
Wow.
And
that already makes me feel feelings. Continue, sorry.
Right?
Yeah.
And we haven't talked about this a lot, but when we were doing one of our really early episodes, Unity, I told you that I experienced a lot of violence in a group of friends that I had in my late teens and early 20s. We haven't really talked about it in detail. And to try to give a little bit of a summary of it, when I started university, Mal and I were actually part of a group of friends that was mostly men. And we were extremely, extremely close. Like, it was, you know, like the unrealistic social groups and sitcoms like Friends and How I Met Your Mother and stuff, where they hang out like every day and they're like super over involved in each other's lives and they just
do
everything together
that.
And exploits and adventures.
Right. Yeah.
That was like, we kind of had like our real life version of that. Like, we hung out every day. Like, we lived, you know, so, like, Mal and I lived together and then some of the guys lived together and we were just like always together and considered each other family and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, how it turned out was more than one of those men ended up sexually assaulting me. Some of them sexually assaulted other people in our group. They were abusive to us when we were in relationships with them. They stalked someone in our group. Like, there was a lot of violence.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really devastating because it wasn't just the violence. It was the betrayal of, like, I really loved you and I thought you were my family and I thought this was like forever, you know, I thought that like I thought you really cared about me the way I cared about you.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually don't want to talk today about those most violent ones, you know, the ones who sexually assaulted or abused or stalked us.
Yeah.
I actually want to talk about the other guys who were part of that social scene. The ones who were not personally violent in that way, but who also didn't stand up against that and who supported it with their silence or with their continued friendship mm-hmm. with those men mm-hmm. and who watched us be so harmed to the point where our lives felt ruined and we felt like we were going to die, and they watched and they really did nothing. Because I feel like, you know, there is, like Bell Hooks talks about, there is this silence where we can't speak up about what men are doing. But when we do, it's about those most violent ones. Mm-hmm. And the other guys are flying under the radar.
As if that, and, like, they never did anything at all, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. They never have to answer for that. And they get to consider themselves better. Mm-hmm. And they get to consider themselves good guys. And, you know, they can consider themselves feminists even, or they can consider themselves, you know, like, different in some meaningful way.
Right.
And so I always say, too, like, not all men are rapists or abusers, but all men benefit from the ones who are.
Yeah.
Because the bar is then set so fucking low.
Yeah.
How many women do you have in your life who, like, if they're talking about an ex-boyfriend, you're like, oh, he seems kind of shitty. And they're like, well, he wasn't that bad. I mean, like, he never raped me or anything. And you're like, I mean.
It's like acceptable. Thanks. Yeah. You know, like, so that's so, yeah, the bar is so low. And yeah, and I think it's interesting. I'm really looking forward to this conversation, you know, because I think a lot of the times when you start to have these conversations about the bar being low and the folks that meet the height of the bar, yeah, we never do have those conversations. I don't think that they stick out as much because everything seems so mundane, like that. Those interactions seem so, no, I wouldn't say taken for granted, but like commonplace and normal, that like mm-hmm. we've normalized the silencing of having these kinds of conversations about, like, what about the other ones who didn't do the worst thing, but still were there, we're still in the room, so to speak, or we're still complicit. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I was actually thinking specifically about this one person kept coming to my mind. And I've thought about, like, whether to say a name or not. And I really don't know. Like, I couldn't come up with an answer for whether I should or not.
What was, like, your debate on the name? Like, why not?
Yeah, why not is a great question.
No, just throwing shit back at you, you know what I mean? Because I totally hear you, but, like, I want to know, for my own personal curiosity, what's been the thought process?
I think it's still out of some kind of, like, misguided feeling like I should protect somebody or I should protect their reputation, or, right? Like, it's not okay to, like, speak publicly about what I experienced, even though nobody protects me from anything.
Right.
So
I hear you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have had, I don't know, I'm not sure where we stand. I had a friend named Kyle, and he's a very, very lovely person in so many ways. Like, I have a lot of really great memories of him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, long after I cut out everybody else from that group, because, again, like, there was the core group, and then there was, like, the slightly bigger group, and there was the people who actually committed the violent acts, and then there were the people who were around and ignored and, you know, didn't care about the violence that was happening, or just didn't stand up against it, but they didn't actually commit it. So there was, like, the first people who got cut out were the ones who committed the violent acts, and then eventually over time, like, I ended up having to cut out the other people who were harming me, and, you know, by not caring or mm-hmm. not believing me or whatever. But Kyle was, like, the last one standing, because, yeah, there's a lot that I really loved about him. And he had left Vancouver and would kind of come back a few times a year or whatever. So I would see him when he'd be in town. So he knew a lot of what happened. And I know that he had stayed friends with a lot of those guys long after we had stopped, and after he knew both from us and from other people what they had done. But I had just, like, I don't know, I had just decided to still be friends with him, and that had just never been addressed. And then a couple years ago, he was coming back into town. So he had messaged me and, you know, it's been saying, you know, how are you doing? And do you want to hang out when I'm back? And I had said, oh, yeah, I'm doing well. And when he answered, he said, oh, glad to hear you're doing well. Although I know that there is, you know, a cap on how well it's possible for any woman to be doing right now because of, you know, the Kavanaugh hearings going on. And when he said that, it just awakened something in me, like this rage where I was like, first of all, don't tell me how to feel. Like, don't tell me how I feel.
Right.
And also I was like, I mean, that's not true for me. Like, I'm not American. I wasn't following the Kavanaugh hearings. I knew that they were happening, of course, and like what was happening. But I mean, it's not news to me that a lot of men rape women and then go on to lead, you know, very, you know, quote unquote successful lives, and that nobody cares about the women that they've raped. And, you know, like, it's not like I knew that was happening, but again, like, that's just my reality that I live in every day. And mm-hmm. I wasn't particularly triggered by that at that time.
Yeah.
So I was very angry that he was contradicting me about how I felt. And especially because I was like, sorry, are you suddenly like so tuned in to this issue? You know, like you're trying to like show off how
like knowledgeable you are about it, how hip to the shits you are. Like, what is the point of saying something like that? And I'm like, all I can imagine is that you're trying to be like, I understand you. And it's kind of what you were saying at the beginning, like people who even might call themselves feminists or might, I guess, identify as like, see, I support that. I know about what's happening. Let me drop that knowledge. It's like white people who like send black people like stories of black people dying or being harmed because they're like, look how smart I am about this shit. It's like, maybe just keep it to your motherfucking self until I disclose that I want to talk to you about it.
Exactly. And so I said all of this, and I said, you know, also like, now you're acting like you're so actively involved with this, but like, where were you when I was experiencing rape and abuse in our social group and then like trying to pick up the pieces after? And
you
were
that?
Nowhere. Yes.
Oh, I love you, girl.
And yes. I'm like, and you know, you were nowhere to be found. And like, when I've tried to talk about it, you've like all but shut it down, you know, because you're uncomfortable. Like, I remember one time trying to talk about abuse that I had experienced with one of our friends and him saying, oh, like, you don't have to talk about this. And I'm like, well, clearly I want to, but clearly you don't want me to. Yeah. Right. Like,
say what you feel. So did he respond, or like, what was his sort of?
He did. And he said that it was kind of a relief that I had brought it up because he'd always felt guilty about the fact that he did stay friends with those people for so long and didn't, you know, stand up against it in any way. And he didn't, you know why I had chosen to still be friends with him.
Survivor's and remorse say, kind of shit. Like, he was like, I'm the last one standing. Like, why me, you know? Like,
okay. Yeah. And, you know, and I think again, with the bar being set so low, like, I think he has noticed it. And there was a lot of guilt, I think, there for him. But I'll say, like, this also is not the first time I had a man who, you know, wasn't abusive or, you know, wasn't violent tell me that they were happy I had brought something up that they were doing wrong because they had felt guilty about treating me that way. And I'm like, you know, there's an option for you to stop doing the thing that's making you feel guilty. That's called a conscience. That's like what guilt is supposed to do, is make you change your behavior. And yet, because of your male entitlement, you're like, well, I guess I'll just keep doing it because I'm getting away with it, right?
Yeah. That's so fascinating, that piece about the guilt that you're saying. I'm sure it comes up for lots of men who are not, quote unquote, that bad, you know, who are like, quote unquote, the good guys, that guiltiness, the consciousness thing. I'm like, what within yourself makes you want to reject tuning into that like bad feeling? Is it like the, you know, the shame it could be associated with guilt? Is it like, because I don't know. I think it's so fascinating, especially the way that we socialize women and girls. We use shame in ways to make them compliant. And oftentimes it seems to work in a more, you know, writ large in society. You can shame and guilt women into doing a lot of things. And it's very coercive and it works very well, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's interesting that you're saying that like the shame or the guilt piece like doesn't really work. Or maybe from what, and I would agree with you, I think a lot of, you know, quote unquote, good guys are, experiencing that guilt, but they're not acting on it. And I just like wonder if it has anything to do with how we're socializing people to like register sort of negative things and how like coercion is used with women and girls and like femme people as opposed to people with like mass privilege and boys and men, you know? So anyways, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that men are taught that they should just be in control all the time and they shouldn't admit weakness in any way. And I wonder if that's part of it, is like that mask they have to put on where they can't show any weakness. If they keep that on, like that's part of why they can't or won't. I shouldn't say can't. They absolutely can.
Yes, that's true.
Why they are unwilling to, yes, you know, be the ones to do that work, to question themselves and admit their complicity and do something different.
Yeah. So he was like, thank you for bringing it up. And you're like, what the fuck? Like, I don't know how, yeah, I would respond to that. That sounds like...
Well, and we had this conversation about it, and I ended up saying to him, I was like, look, I'm not even really that mad about what you did back then at all. Because, you know what? We were young. Like, we all make mistakes. Like, if I had met those men now, like, it would take me about 10 seconds, if that, to be like, red flag, red flag, red flag, bye-bye. Like, get out, exactly, of here, right? Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. But I was, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. Like, I didn't know. Like, I was never taught how to spot abusiveness. I was never taught that I deserved safety and bodily integrity in the way that I know now that I do. So, you know, the fact that when he was also in his teens and early 20s that he didn't get it, like, whatever. I'm not even really mad about that. But I was like, but what are you going to do now, yes, is the thing. Yes. Like, yes, how are you going to show up now? Because as a survivor of that much violence, I've had to spend, I can't even, tens, oh, of thousands of dollars, I must have been by this time, in therapy, and tens, mm-hmm, of thousands of hours, mm-hmm, in therapy and in my life, like trying to heal and trying to, having to change my life and having to, like, I wish, honestly, I wish you could have known me back then, because, like, you know, everybody now makes fun of me for, like, being so old and, like, not going out and partying and things,
oh,
like that.
He was
and,
out.
Like, back then, like, I went out all the time. Mal and I were known for, like, pre-drinking shots of vodka, ooh, and, like, always having, like, the highest weed tolerance and the biggest bongs and, like, being, like, like, you would not even,
yeah, I cannot keep up. I would not have been keeping up. And like, that girl's wild as fuck. I cannot.
Exactly. But like, and I mean, part of that changing is like me just getting older. Part of it is I have fibromyalgia now, which is highly correlated with trauma. Like 91%, yeah, of women with fibromyalgia have experienced sexual or physical violence.
Wow.
And yeah, wow. And like maybe, you know, maybe my trauma from childhood would have been enough to activate that like fibromyalgia gene or whatever it is. But I never got the chance to find out because I experienced all of that violence and now I have this chronic illness. Yeah. And also I just don't feel safe in those settings anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
At all. It's, yeah, so triggering and, yes, like frightening.
Yeah.
I've had to deal with this. And that's the thing, like women and girls and people who are perceived as women and girls and femmes and, you know, survivors of all I mean, listen, everybody can participate in patriarchy and there are people in all of those groups who do.
Yeah, actually, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you in this conversation is like how, and maybe we can get into this later on because I don't want to derail what you're talking about, but like how do people who are not men and boys and don't have mass privilege like perpetuate patriarchy and misogyny too?
Yeah.
I think like misogyny is this tool of patriarchy to like be like hateful and like just like really just feel like you need to like hurt something, whereas patriarchy is like this sort of there are things that are within patriarchy I think that can be seen as like, oh, it's kind of positive, like paternalism. It's like, oh, I care about you, but that really means I want to control you. So I just want to, maybe we can talk about that later, is like how do we participate in it as well, because I think it's within us. The fact that, you know, we're having this conversation about the silence of not being able to talk about that, it's like, well, then how are we then complicit if like we're part of, you know, this community of like we continue to protect people who have harmed us and that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That and, you know, we often buy into some of those same kind of myths about how we have to be, like how we have to coddle and enable, yeah, and how men should be as well. Like, you see a lot of women and girls, and I wouldn't even blame girls because they're kids. Girls, like, you can't, yeah, blame, yeah, you can't, kids for, yeah, anything, yeah, but like there's a lot of women who do expect men to show toxic masculinity, to always be in control, to never show any like supposed weak emotions or, yeah, anything, to want sex all the time, like all, right, of those stereotypes. So we can all perpetuate it for, right, sure. Right, right. Yeah. It's just that some people have a lot more power than others.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important, because I remember having a conversation with one of my friends about this, you know, because she was arguing that whiteness doesn't actually hurt white people, whereas patriarchy and toxic masculinity very much harms men. And I agree that I have no idea whether whiteness harms white people or not, but I agree very much that toxic masculinity and patriarchy harms men, because, well, here's something bell hooks said: there needs to be a willingness to face the fact that patriarchal culture has required of men that they be divided souls. Learning to wear a mask is the first lesson in patriarchal masculinity that a boy learns. He's asked to give up the true self in order to realize the patriarchal ideal. Boys learn self-betrayal early and are rewarded for these acts of soul murder.
I truly believe all of that, but the thing that struck me the most is that, like, the betrayal piece, like, I think that's like you're excommunicating a huge part of who you actually are. And I would say, you know how you were mentioning that your friend said that whiteness doesn't hurt white people? I mean, if we kind of use the same logic, it's like, well, you're like, in some ways, whiteness, I think, and white supremacy, like, excommunicates white people from having like a conscious, sentient soul that cares for other people. Like, and in that, mm-hmm, way, it's like, are you fully human then? Like, if you, mm-hmm, are complicit in the subjugation of people because of race, and it's been something that people who look like you have created, then there's something like ethically, morally, spiritually wrong with you then. And I think it does hurt white people. So anyways, this is very fascinating to me, and I fully agree.
Yeah, and that's like, I wasn't sure. I think what I ended up saying to her was like, maybe it depends on like if you have a spiritual outlook, because like, if you are completely atheist, maybe it doesn't matter if you never like know your whole conscience, as long as you have power. I don't know, like, but I don't know if white people experience the same kinds of like psychological pain and repression that men do when they're not able to access their full range of human emotions, and when they're not able to fully live in integrity, which is something that, another thing bell hooks says, she says, patriarchy encourages men to surrender their integrity and to live lives of denial.
Right.
By learning the arts of compartmentalization, dissimulation, and dissociation, men are able to see themselves as acting with integrity in cases where they are not.
It's so interesting, too. And I remember, I think it was Alok Vaidmanon. I think it was Alok. I was watching something that Alok was talking about. Oh my God, it was so amazing on Friday. I was blown away. It was just like an Instagram live. And they were talking about how like white supremacy and patriarchy will like disguise itself as like the victim also. And so when you're talking about like, it'll see itself as like having integrity even when it doesn't, it's like, it's always playing like games of deceit. It's always playing like this trick on itself to trick itself into believing something. Anything that the oppressed is saying is always a lie, and anything that like the oppressor is saying is always true. So I think it's like, and in that way, it kind of makes me think of like, you cannot be like spiritually, ethically, morally well if that is the way that you are navigating the world, even if you don't even know that's the way you're doing it or like moving. Like, you just cannot be in right community and with yourself and with other people.
Yeah, and well, so here's another bell hooks quote.
Here we go.
The stress of guarding and protecting a false self is harmful to male emotional well-being. It erodes self-esteem. Much of the depression men suffer is directly related to their inability to be whole. Even though they have been socialized to create and maintain false selves, most men remember the true self that once existed. And it is that memory of loss, coupled with rage at the world, which encouraged the surrender of the self, that engenders depression.
Ooh.
And this is something, too, that I remember in this conversation with Kyle, he was sort of saying, like, he wants to do this work, and also it's really hard because, you know, he was really struggling with his mental health. And I, again, it was, like, the same way that I wasn't really mad about what he, you know, did or didn't do back when we were younger. I also get that. Like, I really do get that. Mm. And I do have empathy for all of these things that men go through. It's just like I said, I haven't felt like I've had the choice to
opt out.
Right. Exactly. And this is what I said to my friend when she was talking about, you know, patriarchy hurting men. I was like, yeah, it does. And like, it hurts me most of all, you know, like, so what happens to men if they challenge patriarchy? They, you know, risk experiencing violence. It really hurts their ego. Like, they have power taken from them. They're very much like shamed and abused and all of these things. Well, hello, like, that's what I've been experiencing my whole life, is violence and humiliation and abuse and all of those things. So I have empathy for it, and I want to support men, but I need them to do something. I need them to be actively showing up. And here's the thing. I had this conversation with Kyle, and he was like, yeah, I really want to do this work, and I know it's my work to do. I haven't spoken to him in 2 years. I never heard from him again.
Wow. I think at that rate, it's also, if I may, like, I would feel so betrayed again, because it's like, you put me in a position where we had to have that conversation, and we didn't have to have that conversation. You kind of brought it up, and then you said, thank you for, I'm glad you said something. Also not caring so much if you triggered me or made me feel uncomfortable by that. And then you said that you were committed to something, and this commitment was fostered or sparked from a conversation that I had at the expense of me. And then you didn't even think that you perhaps owed me some form of communication after the fact. It's kind of like, it's so, that's like using somebody and discarding them. That's, I would feel so used at that point. And I would also feel like, and I want to know how you do feel about this. Maybe you're like, I'm so happy he never contacted me again. I don't want to talk to him anymore after that anyways. But like, to me, that also just shows that this Kyle person doesn't seem like he's interested in like the community aspect of this. Like, I get that a lot of the times when we're talking about misogyny and patriarchy, it seems like we're always talking about the people who did like the worst things, and the people who don't do the worst things end up, I don't know. I just want to, for me, it sounds like he didn't have control over himself. Whereas I think for a lot of men, it's like not having control over other people. And I think like, it's sort of sad when you realize that like you're this person that you are trying to support in like whatever learning that they're going to do. Cause that was really supportive of you. You didn't have to have that conversation with him, that he didn't even have sort of like the wherewithal to come back and realize that like at the end of the day, that this is about being in community with you. Because that's what that would have meant. Like even a follow-up of like, thanks for that conversation, even a follow-up of like, hey, so this is how are you? Because in that conversation, was he asking like how you were doing, or was he just talking about his guilt and his shit and the things that he needs to work on and all that sort of thing? It's just like, it's so exploitative.
Yeah. I felt abandoned. You say that you care about these things and you say that you care about me, but then I didn't hear from you ever again. And it's like, okay, I guess you don't care enough to actually be in my life. And this has been my experience consistently, is like, if men actually have to do emotional labor, then they're gone.
Oh God, that's and, such a word. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, and I remember part of this conversation too, him saying something along the lines of like, because I think I brought up how he had not been able to hold space for me if I had tried to talk about it, and he said something along the lines of that he felt like he didn't deserve to support me because of like what he had done or not done before.
Yeah.
And I felt like, wow, you're acting like supporting me is some huge privilege that like you haven't earned in some way. And yet your behavior looks exactly like all the people who don't believe me and don't care. Oh, so they don't support me because they don't believe me. They don't support me because they don't care. But you don't support me because you're not good enough to support me. Like, fuck off.
I think that's where the paternalism comes in, though. It's like, he didn't, in that conversation, those kinds of words to me make me feel like, you're not even willing to ask me what I need. You are willing to decide in your own feelings, in your own state, in your own thinking, 10 steps ahead in the wrong direction about what I need and how you aren't enough or whatever. It's like, maybe for one moment in this conversation that's about me and what I need, you ask me what I need. I don't think these unhealthy masculinities, like toxic masculinities, like aren't interested again in like the collective. They're not interested in knowing how you feel or what you need. It's interested in saying like, I know what you need. So I'm going to just do what I'm going to continue to do and be out of community with you.
Totally. You know? Totally. And it also made me think of another friend, Mark, who again, like wasn't violent towards me, but he aggressively didn't care about the violence that other men he was close friends with perpetrated against me. I remember one time Mal posted something on social media talking about how there needs to be more conversation around childhood sexual abuse so that survivors don't feel so isolated. Mm-hmm. And this other guy who's in our kind of social scene decided to come on and like harass them, basically just talking about how what they were saying was like empty buzzwords and like meant nothing and like what was even the point and all this kind of thing. Wow. And then Mark came on at the end of that thread and just said something like really flippant and like, I can't remember what it was, but again, it was just like showing he like aggressively didn't care. But he was one of my best friends at a certain time. And I remember because after experiencing all that violence and I was sort of still in that kind of, again, because nobody teaches you about like rape culture and that these experiences that you have aren't anomalies. And that like all of the people around who aren't supporting you are actually enabling it, right? So like you keep some of them in your life because they haven't actually done the thing wrong. And you have this like friendship that still means something to you. Like, you know, so you're just so used to people not caring and like not being there for you and like not showing that they believe you that you just accept that as normal.
Yep.
And it was like such a horrible time where like I was just in fight or flight constantly. I was like constantly having like panic attacks and thinking I was dying all the time, and I like couldn't eat, so I got like very, very underweight because like this is just like what I was, how bad everything was. And so I remember like, you know, anytime I had to go on the bus to school or anything, which was like maybe a 15-minute bus ride, I'd like almost pass out because I was like so underweight and just like so unwell. And, you know, Mark and I would often be on the bus together because we lived nearby and like had some classes together. And I remember one time he was about to go on exchange for a semester. And I remember him just kind of like looking at me and saying like, in a very like genuine way, like I actually felt cared for at the time by this, but he said to me like don't die while I'm gone, because you know I was so visibly
unwell. Yeah.
And you know, looking back, it just makes me so angry because I'm like, yeah, you could see exactly how bad it was for me and you chose to not care about why. And to do nothing.
Wow. That's so, it's fascinating how that betrayal that you were speaking of, the quoting bell hooks, it's like a self-betrayal and then it's a betraying of people over and over again. And that, then it makes me think, then who are you loyal to? Like, where does the loyalty in that kind of behavior lie? Who are you trying to prop up? Is it you? Is it your friend? Is it your friend's actions? Is it some, like, I'm curious about how people get there, but I'm just like so grateful that you didn't die, that, you know, like I'm so grateful that you're here and really upset. And I think grateful that you're bringing these pieces up because it's in those kinds of relationships, like you're talking about how like you're so used to people not caring, that it's like it's just bodies in the room, like, and we only know more about what we deserve as we get older. I think it's like such a blessing to like get older and realize like, oh my God, like I'm so grateful to be alive, because like I might have not made it. I didn't have people that were, you know, I had very few people who were actually looking out for me in the ways that I needed them to look out for me, or caring for me in the ways that I needed them to care for me. And so I think so much of this is like, yes, about discussing toxic masculinity, but also just like, how do we be in community and care for people when we see harm happening? To turn away from that is like to really, I'm not saying like, I believe hurt people, but also I believe that like, to your point, some people are hurting way more. So like with the less hurt that you're experiencing, how do you support people who are hurting more than you? you know?
Mm-hmm. And with the power that you've been given.
With the power, yeah.
And that's the thing we need. I can't remember who came up with this concept or if I'm even using it right, but we need traitors. Like, we need people to break that code of silence, yes, of men and masculinity.
Yeah.
And I think there's been a lot of leaders in, like, trans men and butches and some, you know, cishet men. But I've definitely heard trans men talk about what they witness once they're, like, perceived as men and they're in the room with just men and they're like, holy fucking shit. Like,
that's so, it must be so scary, to be honest. That's,
yeah. Yeah. And so we need traitors. We need people to be actually talking about what's happening when it's all men in a room.
Yeah.
And we need people. This is what I feel like when I think back to all these things I've experienced and all of the people who were around who didn't directly perpetrate the violence. I'm like, where are you? Yeah. Because you need to be doing something. You need to be talking. You need to be supporting us, but you also need to be talking to them. I remember, like, a couple years ago, one of my friends was going through a divorce and she was starting to talk about just some of the things her husband had put her through. And she was being gaslit a lot. And I messaged her to say, like, I see it too. Like, I've had these experiences with him and it made me realize, you know, what he's really like. And she was like, will you say that to him? Because no one says it to him.
Wow.
And it was really scary at first. I was like, oh God, I could never say that to him. But then I was like, why not? Mm-hmm. Like, what's he, I'm not physically threatened by this person. I can say it to him. And I did. And so these people like Mark and Kyle, and there's other people from that group, if they really do care, they should be going and talking to those men about what they know and what they saw.
What, as you're talking about this, it reminds me of, I saw a post that Jenna made recently. He was like, I've learned, and the way that I try to like think about being in relation with women and girls and femmes, and the biggest switch in my like relationships and how I respect and identify as a feminist is that I just started from the jump to just believe women, just believe them, like just believe what women are saying to be true. And he's like, once I started doing that, my eyes were opened to so many things that I had chosen not to see previously. Once I started from the starting point of believing women that what they were saying in their experiences with men were true, I couldn't unsee that. And it's like, and then Drew Dixon, who was in On the Record, that HBO Max special about their experiences of sexual violence, and Russell Simmons. So Drew Dixon was interviewed by Kimberly Forrester for Harriet. And it was I watched this yesterday. It was really amazing. And Drew talks about sort of like this condemned cell, which I think you should Google. It's a really interesting concept about like basically when we're talking about violence against specifically Black women, but when we think about this at like as the history of just like women in general, how enslaved women who had enslaved Black men who were trying to like protect Black women were taken and like put in a cell that like couldn't stand up in with no windows and just left there to die. And it was called like the condemned cell. And she was talking about how like she thinks about how these men who were the ones who were trying to protect Black women were condemned to die. And how a lot of us still have that condemned cell in our head where we can turn away from the violence and not really like look at things for what they are. And she was like, the cheat code for fighting against misogyny and specifically misogynoir that she experienced is to support and believe women and girls when they're talking about what they're saying and listen, like taking the time to listen.
Yes. Believe and listen and let it change you.
Yes.
So bell hooks says, if a man is not willing to break patriarchal rules to say that he should never change, especially to satisfy someone else, particularly a female, then he will choose being right over being loved. Mm. He will turn away from loved ones and choose his manhood over his personhood.
Do you remember that episode of Insecure where Molly's talking to her therapist and her therapist says, like, Molly's going off about Issa and Issa this, and then her therapist says, Molly, do you want to be right or do you want to be in community? And yeah. It's like,
yeah, so much of what's missing, I think, in our culture when it comes to men is accountability and responsibility.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of times people think again, like, oh, well, toxic masculinity hurts men so much and they just need our support and we need to like build them up and all this kind of stuff. Yes, we need to have empathy and we need to support men as well. Yes, of course. However,
I love you.
Everything, everything is a balance and a spectrum, yes. Right? And actually in our culture, we do a lot of coddling and that's of men and that's not real support.
Yeah.
And what we don't do enough is actually hold men accountable and ask them to, yes, be in community. Like, I don't think that individual therapy is actually enough for this, you know, like, men, I'm not saying men shouldn't go to therapy. Please, yes, please, please, please go to therapy. Run, don't walk to therapy and work through some of this stuff. Like, there's some amazing, like, Sasha Medine is an amazing Black man who's a therapist in Vancouver who I know does a lot of work around masculinity. Like, there's a lot of people who are doing this work, and therapy is a great place to do it. And we need men to show up in communities, in relationships, and be doing emotional labor, to be giving support, to be holding each other accountable, because only other men can do that in a patriarchal system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. That's so true. Like, it's like, we can have, and you know what's interesting? When we first started thinking, when I started thinking about this episode, I was like, oh, like, I want to talk about this. I love that we're talking about this, but I was also like, we talk about this all the time and nothing changes. So it's like, y'all just listen to each other anyways. So maybe you need to start from there, you know?
Exactly. Like, we need leadership from men. Like, we need them to be in groups with each other, like, speaking openly and like calling each other on their bullshit, because I also think we, outside of like the like man club, like, we don't even fully know all of the sort of rules and like ways that that hierarchy operates. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is work, and there are some men trying to do it, but I mean, all of the men out in communities who think you're not, you know, you're not one of the bad ones.
The worst ones. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Who think that you're the ones who aren't violent. It's like, okay, well, if you're really not violent, you'll be actively working against the violence that's happening all around you all the time.
Yeah. It's like the same thing. It's like literally the parallel of like, okay, are you like not racist or are you anti-racist? It's like, like, you have to be doing something. It's not just about believing it in your body. And I'm happy that you mentioned earlier, like, learn about it, like, listen to women, hear women, believe women, and then do something. Like, what are you doing? Because like, it's not enough to just have it between your ears.
Exactly. So let's end with one last excerpt from Bell Hooks.
Yay.
And someone she quotes as well, Nathaniel Brandon. So Bell Hooks says, "When men practice integrity, they accept that part of the work of wholeness is learning to be flexible, learning how to negotiate, how to embrace change in thought and action. The ability to critique oneself and change and to hear critique from others is the condition of being that makes us capable of responsibility. To be able to respond to family and friends, men have to have practice assuming responsibility. Nathaniel Brandon equates our capacity to be responsible with our capacity to experience joy, to be personally empowered. This sense of personal agency lets us break with imposed sex roles. This is true freedom and independence." So Nathaniel Brandon says, "I am responsible for accepting or choosing the values by which I live. If I live by values I have accepted or adopted passively and unthinkingly, it is easy to imagine that they are just my nature, just who I am, and to avoid recognizing that choice is involved. If I am willing to recognize that choices and decisions are crucial when values are adopted, then I can take a fresh look at my values, question them, and if necessary, revise them. Again, it is taking responsibility that sets me free."
I love it.